Hi, listeners. We have a podcast to share with you that you can go binge over 50 episodes right now.
Every Thursday, we bring you a new episode filled with mysteries, conspiracies, and things that go bump in the night.
I'm Holly Lowerman.
And I'm Brooke Sasser.
And we are the hosts of Curly Conspiracies Podcast.
The name of our podcast stems from, well, our curly hair, and the idea that conspiracies and mysteries are never straightforward.
They take multiple twists, turns, have-nots, and take a while to comb through.
We have some lighthearted topics such as Eminem is a clone, the Coca-Cola conspiracy, and even the Kentucky meat shower.
Some more serious topics like April is Blood Sacrifice Month, the Johnny Gosch disappearance, and the Nahanni Valley mystery.
We also have your classics like the conspiracy surrounding Princess Diana's death, Mothman, and the Roswell incident.
Check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. So, go get your tinfoil hats ready and check out Curly Conspiracies Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige. Innocence. Guilt. Typically, we talk about innocence and guilt within the context of the law. Legally, innocence means the individual is not responsible for the crime they have been accused of. Legally, the person is not at fault. But in the case of John Eric Ashfield, the legal definition of innocence is not at play here. The innocence of a child has been explored in novels, songs, and pop culture as far back as anyone can remember. At the most basic and primary level, innocence has a hint of ignorance in it, but not in our typical meaning of the word. Ignorance of mortality, ignorance of intimate relationships, and the belief of the irrational, like Santa Claus, fairies, and the like. At a deeper level, innocence is burrowed deep within a child's mentality. It's the unbridled trust that people have only the best of intentions. It's a child playing with themselves, singing along as they go. It's that same child's growth of self-consciousness, or even lack thereof. Imagine all you have learned in life from mid to late childhood on. Now, erase it. Erase every bad memory or lesson you learned. Erase the good memories. Put yourself in a state of being where you do just that. You be. Living in a world of play, constant learning, an etch-a-sketch or a light bright with nary a mark or pen on or in it. This is the story of John Eric Ashfield, a young boy who quickly, intentionally, and viciously had his childlike innocence ripped away from him. Let's get started. John Eric Ashfield lived in New South Wales, Australia, and was only 6 years old in 1993. He attended East Nowra Primary School in first grade. His mother was 25-year-old Gunbrit Ashfield, who dated a 20-year-old named Austin Allen Hughes. He had a little sister who was 3 years old named Melissa. Melissa's story and what her mother told the court is completely different, especially when it comes to the question of why this happened and the reason Gunbrit gave for being so angry that dreadful August day. What Gunbrit told the court in December of 1993 was that she was filled with rage when she found out that her 6-year-old son, John, supposedly touched her 3-year-old daughter, Melissa, in a way that he should not have. Gunbrit and her boyfriend, Austin, decided that John could not simply get away with it. In 2007, at the age of 17, Melissa recalled the 5th day of August in 1993, as it was one she will never forget. On that cool, refreshing, yet fateful day, John came home from school. He came home to a place that was supposed to be safe, supportive, and loving. He came home to what was intended to be a refuge. But not on that day, and we will come to find out, not on many days. When he arrived home, his mother's boyfriend, Austin, met him in the kitchen. Words of abuse, hatred, and war dripped from the enraged Austin towards John. Hostility and rancor hoisted itself upon a flagpole of injustice and ill-directed, malevolent persecution. John was the target. Austin told police he soccer-kicked John on the butt, slapped the six-year-old's head around a bit, and made him go into his room immediately. At this point, Gunn, Britt, and Austin thought it was time to, quote, teach John a lesson. Something you would use to explain your actions towards a villain, a worst enemy, someone you despised. Off to the little boy's bedroom they went, where they started to attack and beat him viciously. They both punched him again and again with their fists, then grabbed a rod made of aluminum that was used to hold up a curtain, and they beat him with that. Melissa remembered John crying out, quote, "I'm really sorry, don't do this to me, I'm sore, I'm sorry." In terminology only ever heard from bullies, Austin replied mockingly, quote, "You scream like a little girl." Except this was no bully. This was someone John had spent time with, someone his innocence allowed him to believe was safe. John continued to cry as Austin reached in the closet for a dress. He put the dress over John's head forcefully, yanking his arms through the sleeves. Telling police about the incident, Austin said, quote, "He started crying and carrying on. He was crying, 'Get it off, get it off, I'm not a girl.'" 6-year-old John would unfortunately die a slow and agonizing death. Eventually, she began to wail on him with a hammer she had found until the little boy was too weak to sit upright on the bed. Like a flower who was just beginning to bloom at the age of 6, he began wilting, and soon after, John lost consciousness. When Gunn Britt realized he was out, she took him to the bathroom and ran a cold shower, placing John in the cold water. That didn't work. She turned the hot water on to see if that would wake him up instead. Nothing she tried would wake up the lifeless little boy. A few hours went by before Gunn Britt decided to tell her other kids to call the police while she took John to the Shoalhaven Hospital. She told her children before she left home to tell the police that John had been jumped on at the park by a bunch of teenagers. A television reporter went to talk to the family and put a microphone in Gunn Britt's oldest son's face. He was only 8 years old. Not knowing any better than what his mother told him to say, he went on to tell this fabricated story in a trembling voice for everyone tuning into the news to hear. He said, quote, "We were going to buy milk and bread when 4 boys said, 'Come here, we want to bash you up.'" Gunn Britt and her family were begging anyone with information about her son's murder to come forward. Not long after arriving at the hospital, John would be flown by helicopter from Shoalhaven to Westmead Hospital in Sydney. John was already cold to the touch and blood was spilling out of his nose when he was airlifted. When he arrived at the hospital, he was, sadly, already brain dead. John was put on life support, but they did not leave it on for very long. He was taken off of it at 6:45 p.m. on August 6, 1993, and he passed away. Shortly after this, Gunn Britt and Austin were charged with murder. The doctor testifying in court identified over 100 different colors of bruising, telling the judge that John, a mere child, had been beaten repeatedly and it was no accident. With John's hands also being puffed up and bruised, it indicated he was trying to conceal himself with his hands, possibly even fighting for his life. Additionally, the poundings to John's head caused a very severe brain injury. John's biological father, Brian Ashfield, spoke to reporters, telling them he told the New South Wales Department of Community Services, or NSWDOCS, Gun Britt was vicious and her intent was to harm the children. It was eventually brought to light that the NSW Department of Community Services had received 35 calls concerning Gun Britt and the welfare of the children. Reportedly, Gun Britt even begged the DOCS to remove the kids from her home because she, quote, felt violent towards them. Brian went to his son's funeral with an extremely heavy heart, sobbing over the coffin. Brian has since passed away. Being the optimist that I am, I can only hope he has been reunited with John in an afterlife. It brings some comfort to me while talking about this, and I believe in my heart they are back together. When Gun Britt was sentenced for murder, she wept and shook like a leaf. She didn't have any shoes or socks on, donning blue jeans and a green parka as she sat with her head down, her hair hiding her face. Bail was not applied for, and she didn't attempt to enter a plea. Not much was said about Austin's reaction to being sentenced for the murder of John, only that he was taken into the court, surrounded by police, and he didn't apply for bail. Outside of the courtroom, there were so many people surrounding it, over 100, nearly breaking into a riot in the streets over the brutal murder of a helpless child. One of the reasons Austin didn't apply for bail was that police did fear for his safety if he would have actually been released. One person outside was even taken into custody, and many in the angry crowd tried to jump on Austin as he was being escorted to and from the courtroom. The screams and threats were deafening. Not even a day prior, people were ringing the police station off the hook to provide any help that the family may need after seeing them on the news crying for help in catching John's killers. After it was found out that the mother and her boyfriend really did this to the little boy, the masses were infuriated, and rightfully so. The police prosecutor, Sergeant Jeff Tunks, said that Austin took part in a horrific and systematic beating of the 6-year-old boy over a period of more than 2 hours. After her mother was sent to prison, Melissa was taken into foster care, but at only 11 years old, she ran away. After being in various foster homes, she was put into a nunnery in Grafton until the age of 16. At 16 years old, Melissa became pregnant, but she had a miscarriage. Due to this, she began drinking and acting out as a way to cope with how enraged and grief-stricken she was. When she was interviewed in 2007, she was doing a lot better. She was in therapy and living with her then-boyfriend. Andrew Ashfield, John's uncle, was very angry about the law that prohibited the publishing of what actually happened to his nephew. He said that they, quote, protected the people who killed him and the social workers who let it happen. DCOS knew that she was violent and knew that she was troubled, but they didn't take the kids until after she killed one of them. When John was murdered, John's father Brian had a girlfriend named Wendy, and in 2007, she wanted John's story on every media news outlet possible because she had made a promise to Brian that if Gun Britt or Austin ever applied for parole, she would be there and she would stop them. However, things took a turn in 2011. Gun Britt and Austin both pled guilty in 1993 and were sentenced to 21 years, eventually having their sentences knocked down to 19 years with a minimum of 14. Gun Britt had served 18 years and applied for parole in June of 2011. Melissa was at her mother's parole hearing in late July of 2011 and gave her witness impact statement. Her mother was sitting in the jail at the time, and she showed up to the hearing by way of video. Melissa told her, quote, The day I'll jump for you is the day you drop dead, and you can go to hell. Brian's sister, Annette, was also at the hearing and spoke in a calm tone. She talked about how she had known Gunn Britt, who had then changed her name to Angelique Karstrom, for 28 years. Annette also said that she went to the prison on many occasions to talk to her. At first, you would have thought Annette was going to show pity and mercy on Gunn Britt before she said with a lot of composure, quote, "I want her to stay in jail and die in jail." Looking at Gunn Britt, she went on to state, quote, "I want you to go back to your little cell and hang yourself, or put a bullet in your head." The counsel said Gunn Britt, or Angelique Karstrom, should absolutely not be let out of prison due to the heinous crime, and she had not yet proven she could abide by the laws if she were to be let go. The chair read aloud the authority's ruling. It was said that the positives outweighed the negative when it came to granting her parole, that there was no need in keeping her locked away. Just like that, Gunn Britt, or Angelique Karstrom, was set to be free between August 12th and 19th. Before the chair could even finish the whole statement, Annette jumped to her feet and yelled as she peered at Gunn Britt in the monitor, saying, "See you 6 feet under." Moments after Annette began to stomp out of the hearing, Melissa hopped up as she clenched a photo of John. She held it up to the screen and said, quote, "Have a look at what you did, you fucking mutt." There were conditions of the parole which included Gunn Britt being monitored electronically. She would be administered drug and alcohol tests. There would be a curfew to abide by, and she would have to attend counseling. The things she could not do included living or even visiting the areas where her family resided, and she was not to be around anyone younger than 16. The family requested that Gunn Britt not be allowed to visit John's grave, and that request was granted. When she walked out of the prison on August 15, 2011, at age 43, she was led by probation and parole officers to a secret residential facility where she would spend the next year. There was not a family member of the now Angelique Karstrom to be seen as she left the prison that day. As for Austin Hughes, he had been let go 2 years before Gunn Britt's release, and he was going by the name Blaine Lopez Smith. By October of 2012, Austin, or Blaine, was 38 years old and in trouble with authorities yet again. He was living in West Kempsey under a new name that he had never told police about. He was also living with his new girlfriend, who had two children. It was found out that he even took the children by himself to Kempsey Airport at least 3 times. He was eventually caught when authorities wanted to know about his time spent online. Austin blatantly lied about a Facebook page under the name of Blaine Smithy that was run by his sister. He claimed that he had no idea what the password to the Facebook was, and he likely would never use it. However, there was a photo found on the page by a detective that indicated Austin was lying. It was posted September 24, 2011. Austin's lawyer said the man was being victimized, that his client found it difficult to readjust his life after spending so many years of it locked behind bars, and that Austin was scared since he, before then, was somewhat anonymous. But now someone knew who he was, and it would eventually get out. The woman Austin was dating, who reportedly did not know before this who he really was, showed up at the court in support of him. When he was arrested for this back in January of 2012, family members of Austin's told the news that he never spent the night with his girlfriend while the kids were there, and he was trying to build up the courage to explain to her who he really was. It was now October, and even though Melissa Ashfield and her other siblings spoke out months prior, expressing their fears and worries about the safety of this woman's children, she decided to keep Austin in her life. He was given 200 hours of community service. There are a wide variety of people who deserve or have a right to protection. Children are at the top of the list. John should have been able to live a life surrounded by love, support, and encouragement. He should have been able to comfortably come home from school to a refuge. He should have been able to let loose at home and know that his every endeavor to learn, grow, and change would be supported by those who love him. But for everything that should have been, the opposite occurred. For every should, there was a did not, or wasn't able to. The actions of the people we speak about on this podcast are reprehensible. Most reprehensible are the actions taken against the innocence of a child. Ripping that away, making the decision to remove it from a child, well, that is unforgivable. And while that is an uncomfortable reverie, it's one we should contemplate. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode, and until next time, stay safe and take care.